I have to begin with a confession. I love maps, and not just the foldable glove compartment variety. My living room wall features an enormous map of Europe and the poster of the famous New Yorker cover that shows Manhattan in close detail and everything west of it as an afterthought. They are both art, both transmit important information, and both tell stories, which is what got Vincent Vierga interested. Maps, he says, are like time machines that tell us as much about the society that created them as the places they describe. Along with the Library of Congress, Vincent Vierga pulled together 200 remarkable maps from ancient Mesopotamia to a map of the human genome, and he uses them to give us a tour of the world in a new book called Cartographia. What's your favorite map, and why? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Vincent Vierga is with us here in Studio 3A, and thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me. I'm very grateful to be here.
And why don't I begin with that same question? What's your favorite map, and why?
Well, I think my favorite map is the Ruysch map, which was a map made in 1504. And the reason it's my favorite map is because it's the map that opened the world of maps as cultural landscapes to me. I mean, I grew up with teachers using maps as wayfinding tools. And most historians are visually, they're word people. So they don't approach maps as visual memoirs. They don't look at them as an expression of the people who made them. And I think the Ruysch map, when I first saw it at the library, is a map that's in the old order. It essentially shows Asia and Africa and Europe with this thing sitting there. Because the word had come back to Ruysch from Columbus that he bumped into something on his way around the globe. And Ruysch didn't know what to do with it. So he took it and he placed it below Asia. And he put a note on the map that says, "We don't know yet which way this trends." And when I looked at that, I was stunned because I thought to myself, oh my God, here I am standing with the mindset of the people who made this. This is an image of the people's approach to reality in that period of time. So I began to ask questions like, how do maps differ? How do different cultures express themselves? What is the memoir of every map? And I found it took me 8 years because in order for me to understand a Chinese map, for example, I had to understand the essence of the Chinese sensibility. And the Chinese have five directions. They have north, west, east, south, and center. Now, I know that I am always at the center of my own landscape, so that when I looked at that map, I thought to myself, oh, I get this. That's why I have to turn this around in this way. And then I discovered that while I was looking at that map, the things on the map had been moved around. At the center of the map, there is a fort. And the reason that fort is there is because the map is saying to me, this region is on our southern border, and it is very, very important. Therefore, we're putting it at the center of the map. We've moved it. Hmm. Now, you know, Alfred Hitchcock does the same thing in North by Northwest. When we discover that Cary Grant has, in fact, been thrown to the wolves, we go into this room in Washington, D.C., and Leo G. Carroll lets us know that, in fact, Cary Grant's been mistaken for somebody else, but that's just too bad. And there's a shot of him standing in front of a window, and out the window is the Capitol building. Well, that Capitol building could not be there unless that building were built in the middle of the mall. Now, many people look at that and laugh and say, isn't he stupid? Isn't Alfred Hitchcock stupid? Aren't the movies crazy? But, in fact, the movies are doing exactly what that Chinese map is doing. The movies are making a point, an emotional point. They're drawing us into the image filled with all kinds of information that we can read.
Yeah, there's another map of China, again, just looking at different ways of expressing it, a map of Hainan Island, which is roughly the shape of a teardrop if you look at it on a real map. And this map presents it as almost a rectangle.
Right, right. Feng Shui.
Yeah.
And I think that's also something that I had to understand. You know, what is going on here? The Chinese have two forms of mapping. They have the objective and the subjective. And so the maps meant physical, mental, and spiritual business for them. And we do the same thing in our own ways. I think the book is structured in a very basic way. We begin in the Mediterranean world with Babylonia, and then we move around Asia with Marco Polo. But what we do is, when we reach something like Vietnam, a place like Vietnam, we then bring you up to date. in Vietnam. Because I believe Susan Sontag's wonderful phrase, time's relentless melt. Essentially, I find that is what a map is about. You have discoveries that were made centuries apart, brought together and put on a level playing ground. And in order to understand that, I go back to the movies and I think, you know, if you want to look at film noir and really understand it, you need to put it in its context. You have to understand the culture that created it. You need to understand the stories that it's telling, the emotional freight that it's carrying. Well, each map is like that. And with the Roisch map, when I looked at that information, the new embedded in the old, I also, to go back to the movies, I thought about D.W. Griffith's great movie, Way Down East, in which you have a 19th century structure. And then in the center of it, you have Lillian Gish and Richard Balthamer's inventing modern screen acting in front of our faces. And so I began to look at what was in front of my face. I began to look at the maps and ask them, what is this? Why do you look like this?
And there is a... I guess there's an impulsion, particularly in the West, I suspect. Well, it's an old map. It's got old information. Let's throw it out.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's why most historians, when they write their books, they don't use maps as a way into the past, which is why for so many of us, maps have been relegated to footnotes. Mm-hmm. You know, who needs this? You know, the mountains aren't really there. Well, in fact, the mountains are where they needed to be in that moment in time, because that's where they were in the imaginations and in the minds of the people, which is why I see maps as time machines. You can travel into the heart of a country in the period that the map was made by looking at it. And some maps lie. Some maps tell us stories because the map maker needed to make his point. He had a job to do.
An agenda.
An agenda, absolutely. And we still do that. There's the Red State map, for example, that I discuss in the back of the book. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful when you look at that map because they said, oh, there were all these red states. Well, some people took those maps and they broke them down because, in fact, we're divided into counties. And there are many blue counties in those red states. And when you work with the colors on the map, when you transform that map into the expression of what actually has gone on in that election, you see that the election was, in fact, a tie. So that what I do is I call that, it's an example of maps as mapism, because each one of the maps becomes a metaphor, a visual metaphor for its time. And they're deeply moving and funny. But mostly...
And beautiful.
Beautiful. Oh, absolutely, absolutely beautiful. And, you know, I was reading a book last night about a history of the movies, and in it, Maria Montez is quoted as saying, I am so beautiful, it makes me scream. And I look at this book and I think, yeah, this book is so beautiful because maps are so beautiful. And they make our imagination scream. They just ignite us when we look at the maps. If we look at what we are seeing...
We are going to be able to talk about just a few of the maps, but our web producer, Beth Novi, has put together a gallery full of images from the book. You can see those at our website. Just go to npr.org/talk, and there's this wonderful gallery, and Vincent Virga has been kind enough to add some commentary as well, so you can get that. In the meantime, let's get some callers in on this conversation, 800-989-8255, and let's start with Mike, and Mike's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share a quick story about a friend of mine that moved to San Francisco last year, and she had up in her apartment, every time a friend would come over to her house, she would ask the friend to draw a map of the city. Mm-hmm. And so she had maps of the city up on her wall, you know, from wall to wall, and it was really fascinating to see the different things that, you know, each individual would think about when they think about the city of San Francisco, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, the different things mm-hmm. they would put into the map.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, they call them psychological maps, and they do that with children. The little ones will go out in the street and they'll draw their front yard, and then as they get older, they'll draw the block. And then, of course, when they become adolescents and they have a bicycle, they can draw the whole little neighborhood. And also, there's a wonderful map in the book from a Polish boy who draws an image of the world. And for him, the United States is depicted as one form of bomb, and Russia is depicted as another form of bomb. And we look through what is a rifle sight, and the it expresses perfectly his anxiety and his fear, his Caldwell anxiety. But I love the idea of maps because when I started this book, I was a little cartophobic because I have a lot of trouble with street maps. And so as I began to explore maps and put them in the context of visual metaphor, I also became very conscious of that. And has already been mentioned, that map of New York City, that Steinberg map. When I first looked at that, I'm a native New Yorker, and I thought, oh, yeah, I get that. You know, what is out there? You know, it's a sort of map as egotism. But then as I began to work on this book, I discovered a statement. Senator Clinton once said that there are more soldiers that have come from the state of New York than any other state. And suddenly I looked at that map and I thought, oh, look at this, Fortress New York. And then, of course, after 9/11, I looked at it and I thought, oh, boy, vulnerable New York. So the layers in that Steinberg masterpiece became more and more complex the more that I learned about the map as a statement and a place. And, you know, one of the great things is the transforming of experience in space to abstraction of space. It's a revolution in the modes of thinking. And for me, I'm most concerned with the experience that the map expresses, as opposed to just the space that the map depicts. And I think most people who look at maps are really primarily interested in space. But I'm merely interested in the way the King of France invented France by defining himself as France. So he made space a place called France. And that's all expressed in the maps. And that's really what the book is about.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike.
Thank you.
We're talking with Vincent Virga about his new book, Cartographia, Mapping Civilizations. To see some of the maps we're talking about, you can go to npr.org/talk. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Daniil, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
In Florida. Go ahead, please.
Well, my husband and I just got back from a trip to Chicago in early November, and we happened to see the map exhibit that they had at the Field Museum, which was amazing, just in the different types of maps, including several from island nations that were just made with twigs and knots, and actually mapped the currents of the waves so that the island people could find their way. And we've always loved maps, and we just found those just so exciting because, most maps you kind of look at and you can kind of figure out what you're supposed to be seeing. But with those, you really already had to intuitively have a sense of the wave patterns to actually, get yourself where you were going.
Oh, absolutely. They're one of the great, great achievements for me. I have one in the book.
Oh, do you?
I do. And,
well, in my favorite type of map, I think it was in the medieval period, where they essentially would have a very long linen tape that would say start in London, and they would just do this very narrow little map that was essentially following the road, and you might have some things that you would see on either side of the road, and let's say your destination was Rome. At the very end of this long tape was, got you into Rome, but you would just kind of roll up the unroll and roll up the tape as you went each day so that you kind of knew where you were going. But the map was very compact because it was just linen and just rolled up and you just unrolled it as you needed it.
Right, and that's what we have now with the road maps that you get from, we used to get them from the gas station.
Yeah, but, and you used to get them from like AAA.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Like trip maps, yeah.
That's right. So maps are such a part of our lives, and that stick map is particularly moving because they were used. They were literally used by people who memorized the surface of the sea. It's a mnemonic device, a memory tool. And when, Mark Twain wrote a wonderful book, Life on the Mississippi, in which he describes the way the steamboat captains memorized the Mississippi. So when they were going down, if the ripples were different at certain places, they knew that a tree may have fallen in there and that they might be in danger, so that they had to memorize the surface of the Mississippi.
That's amazing.
And these people who used these beautiful, beautiful stick charts, they knew the direction of the winds. They knew that the way the sea responded to islands formed different patterns of ripples. And so you were absolutely right. They memorized the surface of the sea. And that was something that disappeared When the British appeared in the 1880s, they came with their charts. And it was so much easier to just stick a chart in your pocket than it was to memorize these ritual surfaces of the sea. And there was also a very real spiritual link. I think that relationship expressed in those stick maps is one of the great relationships that human beings have ever had with the sea and with the earth.
Thanks very much for the phone call.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
And I wanted to ask you before you go, there's a quotation you have in your book from a cartographic historian, J.P. Harley. Maps, he says, are preeminently a language of power, not protest.
That, he is my hero. It was Harley who helped me look at maps in this new way, what he called the new nature of maps. It was he who said, you know, maps are essentially about power. And the great example of that is, why is Europe a continent? It's a peninsula. India is also a peninsula. India is bigger, in fact, than Europe. But why is Europe a continent? And it's all about power. It's about the way that maps were used to dominate, to gain control, as knowledge is also power, and maps are about knowledge. Maps are among the most exciting things mankind has ever created, and I think my book is about the joy that comes from that. It's also about the bonds that bring us all together. Every civilization mapped. It's a human impulse, so that I believe it is this spiritual experience to join with our brothers and sisters all over the world and see how we are placing ourselves in space. Mm. It's about unity.
To look at maps, going from the maps that were put on the insides of sarcophagi so Egyptians could find their way to the underworld, to maps of the human genome. You can look at Vincent Verga's book, Cartographia, which is produced with the Library of Congress. And again, you can see examples of some of these maps at our website at npr.org/talk. Vincent Verga, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.